You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6, it was last changed 30 years ago. Whether it's the ERA, abortion, guns, or the Electoral College, there's an appetite to update the Constitution. Others say, leave it alone. What, if anything, should our next constitutional amendment be? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a lot of us like to laugh at comedy, but not all jokes are funny to everyone. There have been some recent controversies over material from comics like Dave Chappelle and Ricky Gervais, accused of crossing a line on issues affecting transgender people. These questions aren't new, from minstrel shows of the 1800s to a dust-up over comedians like Andrew Dice Clay in the 1980s. There's been a long back and forth over comedy that addresses race, LGBTQ issues, religion, and more. Comedians like to push boundaries, and comedy writers today are navigating a line between what's funny and what's offensive. Is everything fair game for comedy, or are there lines that shouldn't be crossed? Want to hear your answers to those questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes for good comedy? Do you have a line you draw between funny and offensive? Should comedians just target, go after whatever they want? Or is there something that you say, you know what, I'm done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Dickers is a comedy writer and a founding editor of the satirical news outlet The Onion, born here in Wisconsin. He's a New York Times bestselling author of multiple books, including How to Write Funny, creator of Jim's Journal, and he was previously an intern for The Larry Miller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob. It's delightful to be back here.
Good to have you back. Now, you've been writing comedy for years and years, sometimes, I imagine, in a room by yourself, sometimes in a writer's room.
Sometimes in a room right there at Wisconsin Public Radio at night.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay. Now, when you're working with other writers, I mean, how have you talked over the years about these issues? Like, is this crossing a line? Are we offending people? Should we worry about if we're offending people? What kind of conversations have you had over the years?
Oh, so many. So, we don't really talk about a line necessarily, I guess. That's a word a lot of people use. Mm-hmm. I think of this old phrase that came from journalism, which was comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And this is what I always talk to people about when they're doing comedy. We all know the whole idea of you shouldn't punch down. The other side of that equation is you should punch up. So you should make fun of the established power structures, politicians, you know, any kind of institution that is lording over us in one way or another. But if it ever feels like you're punching down, if you're making fun of a victim, if you're ridiculing a disenfranchised group or anything like that, audiences will not like the joke. Now, does that mean all audiences are part of the woke left? Kind of. Like, that's kind of the rule. So you can feel it in an audience. And obviously, if you're writing comedy and putting it on a website, you don't see the audience. But you get letters and you get a sense of it. And audiences are progressive by nature. They don't like to see people kicked while they're down. So that's why people like Dave Chappelle are getting so much heat for the trans material, because, I mean, that wasn't really even jokes. You know, there are trans comedians who do trans jokes, and they're making fun of themselves, their predicament. They're doing it in a knowing way. But if you're going to go on stage like he did and say that trans people literally don't exist, it's offensive to anyone with half a sense of, you know, civility or community, that these are legitimate human beings and we should allow them to have their experience. If you're not doing that, then a lot of people are not going to like what you're doing. And, you know, you can cross those lines. You can do that. It's a choice you make. There might be some people who enjoy it, a small minority of people who are going to laugh right along with you. But the majority of the audience is going to be feeling a little icky when you do that.
Now, with the Dave Chappelle comedy special in particular, it got a lot of views on Netflix. It seemed like it went pretty well. And, you know, maybe some of that was, maybe I'm uncomfortable with those bits. But overall, Dave Chappelle is pretty funny, so I'll ride it out. I mean, it doesn't seem like he paid a huge cost for that material.
No, he's Dave Chappelle, so he's fine. You know, if you're a comedian starting out, and you go out there and do that, you're going to get booed off the stage because they don't like you yet. So he operates by a different set of rules. And that's just the way it is. You know, I'm sure he would tell you that he has gotten a lot of heat because he probably never hears the end of it. You know, it caused a lot of controversy. Netflix had to step in, and it was just a really unfortunate mess. So yeah, he did fine at the end of the day. And that's kind of what I'm saying. It's like, you make the choice. And if you're going to kick someone who's down, in other words, make fun of a disenfranchised group. But again, he didn't even really make fun of the group. He basically said they don't exist. He doesn't believe they exist. So that's a really insensitive thing to say. And you're going to have people complaining. And like I said, you're also going to have people who don't care, who don't mind, who say, he's funny, you know, I'll take the rest of it. And that's a choice that every comedian, comedy writer has to make. And you have to make it based on how well do people already like me? How much capital do I have to expend on this? You know, The Onion was around for a long time when we put out a really offensive tweet, and people were really, you know, offended and got a lot of angry letters, got a lot of media attention. But The Onion had been around for like 25 years at that point. It's not going to ruin us. You know, we can handle it. We'll move on. People will forget. But if you're just starting out, you can't really afford to do that. Or if you just met someone, you're telling a joke in mixed company, you know, good luck to you.
Talking to Scott Dickers, founder of The Onion, a New York Times bestselling author of books, including How to Write Funny, looking at comedy and when people take offense at a comedian, at comedy writing. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Are there comedians or shows, TV shows or whatever, that turned you away because of something they did? Is there something you tolerated in spite of it? Or do you not worry about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to Rowan Atkinson, known as Mr. Bean and Blackadder from a couple of well-known British comedy series. He made the case in an interview here with Ireland AM that it's the job of comedy to offend, that every joke has a victim. Here's a listen.
I'm a great believer that artists should never apologize for their art. You put something out there, you paint a watercolor, you make a joke, you make a television show, whatever it is. If people are offended, that's their problem. It's not yours. You've done your bit. If they don't want you to work for them again, then that's, you know, that may become your problem, but you've done your bit and you've done your best, and it's up to the audience to judge.
So you put it out there into the world and don't really worry, I guess, about that, the response people might have. Scott, what do you think?
Well, no, every comedian worries, and I know he worries, and it's a sexy thing to say in an interview, but I can't remember anything Rowan Atkinson has ever done that made me bristle and think, ooh, that was over the line, because he's very good. He's one of our better comedians and comic writers. So, yeah, I basically agree in principle that, yeah, you can put out anything you want, but any comedian or any comedy writer is going to think about the consequences. They're going to think, are people going to accept this? Because comedy doesn't, it's not a one-way street. Comedy requires an audience. It's not art. So in that way, I would disagree with him. Comedy is entertainment. If the audience doesn't laugh, it's not funny and it doesn't work. So you need that audience to like what you're doing. Again, if you wanted to be really offensive and you want to cross lines all day, you might get a small sliver of the audience who thinks you're just great. And if you want to, you know, appeal to that niche, that's your option. Like he said, you can put it out there and you do your best. But I do agree with him that I don't think a comedian should ever apologize for their work. I hate that idea. Like, yeah, if someone is offended, it truly is their fault. On the same side of that coin, the comedian has a responsibility to try to entertain and make the audience laugh, as opposed to bristle with offense in large.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, I agree that the best comedy addresses the people, the audience. If you can gauge how the audience is feeling. I have two examples I'd like to share. We had a comedian come to the Tri-State Fair years ago in Douglas County. And he was looking at, you know, hundreds of people. And he said, you know, Superior seems like a pretty nice place when they finally get it finished. And everybody laughed because there was road construction and everything going on. And everybody thought that was funny. And there was another time at the cathedral where the priest on a, you know, it was 100 degrees out. Everyone was fanning. We didn't have air conditioning. And the priest said during his homily, this only was the shortest homily I ever heard. He goes, well, it's hotter in hell. Let's rise and profess our faith. And everybody laughed. But it was, you know, addressing the audience and how the audience was feeling.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, I guess reading the room in some ways and having fun with what you know your audience is.
Yeah, any kind of, you know, one thing that always kills on stage is making fun of the place you're at, because people love to hear their city or their state made fun of, you know, good-natured ribbing.
Jeff, thanks for that call. We are talking to Scott Dickers, from the founding editor of The Onion, longtime comedy writer, looking at modern comedy, the line between funny and offensive. And still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Have your comedic sensibilities changed over the years? Do you ever go back and listen to stuff from when you were a kid and laugh, cringe, maybe both at the same time? Are there things for you that you're like, nope, that's too far, I don't like that bit, or I'm done with this comedian or this show or this author, or you name it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Scott Dickers. He's a comedy writer and author who helped found the satirical news outlet The Onion here in Wisconsin, with us today looking at how comedians and comedy writers navigate modern sensibilities between what's funny and what's harmful in comedy. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Who are some of your favorite comedians? How do they walk the line, if they do, between funny and offensive? Do you like comedy that pushes the boundaries? Or do you think there's some boundaries you'd rather not see pushed? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Scott, I'm thinking back at an older example with what you were saying earlier about, you know, if you're saying things that are offensive and how it'll affect your audience. I want to go back to like the minstrel shows of the 1800s, early 1900s, where, you know, it's white people in blackface enacting stereotypes of black people for other white people. And I'm guessing some of the white audiences found it hilarious. And then the comedians there got, you know, big laughs from the white audience and nobody really thought about what it said about the black people that were being made fun of.
No, Amos and Andy was one of the more popular radio shows, and they went on TV. Like, they were playing that on old-time radio in my lifetime. So there's a thing about comedy that if you're not very aware of all of the various audiences that you're performing to or writing to, your comedy might not age well. So back then, they were figuring, well, our audience is white people, so we're going to make fun of black people, and the white audience will enjoy that. Everybody will be happy. Then we sort of expand it's like the analogy would be the expanding the circle of liberty. You know, we're expanding the audience. So, okay, if black people are part of the audience, maybe you don't want to make fun of black people in these stereotypical ways, because now they're part of the audience. And then in the 70s, 80s, we had a lot of like gay humor making fun of gay men. And that was like, we had Three's Company, you know, gay joke after gay joke. That kind of fell out of fashion in the 90s, I would say, when gay men started to become enveloped in that expanding circle of liberty or audience. And we keep expanding that. And so now the most marginalized group is trans people. And so that's why we have a lot of these issues. If you notice, like, in the 80s and 90s, the biggest laugh you could get on Saturday Night Live was two men kissing. People are laughing. It's so outrageous. Oh my God, can you imagine two men kissing? Then they realize, oh, you know, there are actually men in our audience who like kissing men. And they don't like that joke, because we're mocking this thing that they're literally trying to get the right to legally marry someone. And they get that right. Of course, it's probably going to get rolled back any day now here. But now it's not funny. You don't see that performed anymore. But trans people have not achieved that station that gay men have achieved. So you can make fun actually, it's less now in mainstream comedy, but I would say in the aughts between 2000, 2010, you would see a lot of transphobic humor, much like you saw gay humor in the 80s and 90s. And I've always endeavored to do comedy at The Onion that was, you know, just a little more woke. Like, you want to be perceived as being no holds barred. You know, you'll make fun of everybody, equal opportunity offender. But again, if you're kicking people who are down and you're making fun of a group as if that group isn't in the room, it's not going to age well. So, you know, The Onion's had its fair share of gay jokes, trans jokes, et cetera, but we're never making fun of them like they're not in the room. We're having fun with them, and they're part of the humor. And that's the kind of humor that ages well.
A lot of the response to criticism of comedy that transgresses some of those rules that kicks down, I guess, centers around the phrase cancel culture. That, okay, if I can't do whatever comedy I want to do, you're taking something away from me. What do you make of that, the rise of this concept of, this isn't just in comedy, obviously, but the rise of the concept of cancel culture as it relates to comedy?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a huge range. You know, there's the cancel culture where someone applies for a job and then their boss finds out that they wrote an offensive joke 20 years ago, so they don't hire them or they fire them right away. You know, that's, I think, the example of cancel culture that everyone kind of doesn't like and wishes would go away. But then there's, you know, somebody like Louis C.K. who, you know, sexually assaulted all these comedians who he had in a room with him, who look up to him and who thought he was going to be giving them comedy career advice. And so someone like that, I think it's fair that, like, for me, like, I have a hard time watching his comedy now, because anytime he does a joke about masturbation, which he does a lot of them, I can't help but picture that. And it's an icky feeling. So, like, Louis C.K. kind of ruined Louis C.K. for me. And does that equal canceling? I don't know. I think it's just consequences for behavior that we used to tolerate that now we realize is something we shouldn't tolerate. You know, Harvey Weinstein should have gotten canceled. I think that's a good cancellation. But yeah, should we cancel people because they told an insensitive joke a few years ago? No, I don't think you should ever cancel people for their art or their creativity. And I would be the last person to hold a grudge against somebody who wrote a joke 20 years ago and forbid them from getting a job. But if somebody's actually raping people in their spare time, totally different. Cancel them.
Talking to Scott Dickers, founding editor of The Onion, looking at comedy, when funny becomes offensive, how people in the business, comedy writers and comedians, handle these issues. Scott, I read something on your blog, your How to Write Funny blog. It wasn't talking about this in particular, but I thought it fit pretty well, the idea of, hey, the internet, people are writing jokes all the time. If you are trying to be the first one to respond with this obvious joke, somebody's probably going to beat you to it. I think about this with, you know, if your jokes are the stereotype, the same, you know, Don Rickles Polish joke or whatever back then, or the same gay joke in the 1980s or whatever, it's not that original. You're kind of doing the same shtick as everybody else. Does this kind of thing lead to just bad and lazy comedy too?
Yeah, it can. Just not being original is really the greatest sin that a comedian or a comedy writer can commit. So having a unique voice and having, you know, is like having a unique fingerprint. So if you know who you are as a comedian, what your comedic voice is, you almost can't help but be original. If you're just writing the same hack jokes that everybody else is writing, yeah, chances are somebody's going to write that same joke and beat you to it nowadays. You can't win.
Are there things that, you know, when you came into the business X number of years ago, you look back and think, I might have done things differently now, knowing what I know?
I mean, there were certainly mistakes made, and we told a lot of offensive jokes that maybe today I wouldn't make. But when you're starting out, you kind of have to make those mistakes. You have to figure out where your comfort ends, and So I don't regret that, because it certainly taught us a lot to make a lot of offensive jokes, you know, and to almost get sued by certain people for making fun of them or making fun of their companies or whatever. There's a good amount of that in the Onion's history. So I can't say that I would do anything differently, because you got to learn that stuff. You got to kind of explore and see what works for you and what works for your voice and what the audience will tolerate. So again, that makes it even more difficult for the beginner comedian who's just starting out. You know, they kind of have to be the safest, because if they make a mistake, it's really easy for their confidence to dry up or for their career to fizzle or for them to not get booked. But if they're established, they've been around for 20 years, you know, Louis C.K. still has a career. You know, he's got plenty of people who don't mind what he did and are happy to buy his stuff. I see him in a lot fewer TV shows, and I see him talked about a lot less, and he is kind of marginalized, but he's doing fine because he's got that reputation. He's got that long history, and he's established himself.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Scott Dickers, comedy writer, founding editor of the satirical news outlet The Onion. He's the author of several books and offers courses on comedy through his website, howtowritefunny.com. He was with us today to share how comedians and comedy writers like him toe the line between funny and offensive. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new U.S. Supreme Court ruling will limit the EPA's authority to stop climate change emissions. We'll find out what's changed and what kind of tools are still on the table after that ruling. And firearms labeled as assault weapons were banned for a 10-year period in the United States. We'll look at the impact of the ban at the time and the recent wave of public shootings using similar weapons. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, our guest makes the case for cash and says that continuing to use it is a political act and a personal pushback against a powerful merger of big financial and technology industries. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, rents are high in many Wisconsin communities. We'll find out what's going on and check out some possible solutions. First, you may be familiar with the phrase cash is king, or the song cash rules everything around me. But the reign of cash, actual money that we actually carry around, might be coming to an end. More and more of our transactions have been happening digitally. The daily ones, monthly ones, the big ones, the small ones. Might feel like the move away from cash is a natural phenomenon, but our next guest says the leaders of the global financial system have been actively pushing us toward a cashless future for decades. Do we really want it? Is cashless better for us? We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you still use cash a lot? If so, how regularly? How have you chosen to keep it up? Has the pandemic changed how often or whether you use cash? Have you switched to more online transactions for things? Do you use a card instead of cash money more often? And what do you think of the idea of no cash at all at some point in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Brett Scott is a journalist, monetary anthropologist, and former financial broker. He's the author of the book, The Heretic's Guide to Global Finance, Hacking the Future of Money. His new book out today is called Cloud Money, Cash, Cards, Crypto, and the War for Our Wallets. Brett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, great to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
There's a story I think you're trying to contradict in this book, the idea that, okay, we consumers just sort of naturally want seamless, frictionless, cashless transactions. And so the market, of course, is stepping up to answer that public demand. It's a little more complicated than that, you say.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, one of the big things I'm trying to do in the book is to rebalance the story that we have about why there's been a decline in the cash system. So the typical story that we always told is that it's driven by us. You know, we're the ones who are naturally moving away, as you say. So it's presented as a kind of bottom-up phenomenon, whereas I'm filling in the other side of the story. I'm showing that actually for a long time now, there's been many top-down pushes against the cash system. and that there's many commercial and political interests at play. And what's been happening is that we've been slowly pushed more and more towards this so-called cashless future, which is actually a bank-dominated future. And actually, it's not in the public's interest to have the cash system go into decline. And actually, we need to maintain the cash system and maintain it as a public utility.
Why is it important to me and anybody listening that, we still have cash around, we still have that as an option to buy stuff?
Sure. You know, one of the metaphors I often say to people is, you know, cash is like the public bicycle system of payments. And by contrast, you know, your cards and all those apps that you use, they're very much like the private Uber system of payments. And, you know, you might like using Uber occasionally and so on, but that doesn't mean you want the entire payment system under the control, or the entire transport system under the control of Uber. And similarly, you might like your apps and you might like these digital payment systems, but you really want to maintain the cash system in order to maintain the resilience of the payment system. And actually, there's many negative consequences of the end of cash. In particular, you'll see lots of exclusion, you'll see surveillance, potential for political censorship, you'll see a drastic reduction in the resilience of payment systems. And also, you just see a large amount of power being concentrated into the financial sector, which is already a very powerful industry.
Take us to the, 37th floor of a skyscraper where one of these bank industry groups or a financial technology group, we'll talk about how they're coming together in a bit. Why do they care if I buy my donuts, say, with a credit card or a debit card versus handing over cash for it? So when you put all those transactions together, what do they get out of that?
Sure thing. Well, I mean, you know, the Bank of America CEO openly declared, he said, we want a cashless society. And the reason why he wants a cashless society is that the banking sector, the banking industry, controls the underlying account infrastructures that you use when you're doing card payments or you're doing so-called cashless transactions. I mean, bear in mind, this term cashless is a euphemism. It's a little bit like calling, you know, whiskey beerless alcohol. You know, it's a kind of like a, you know, it's not like incorrect, but it's a very evasive way of describing the situation. What a cashless society really is a society where even your smallest of transactions have to go via the banking sector, all right? And even, you know, there's lots of institutions that are built on top of the banking sector, like PayPal as well. But in the end, it's all rooting through the banking sector. So of course, it's in the commercial interests of the banking industry. They not only make fees from all of those so-called cashless transactions, but they also get huge amounts of data. And then, of course, there's the payments companies like Visa and MasterCard, who basically specialize in telling the banks who to move money, you know, telling them who's trying to move money from which bank account to which bank account. And then there's the fintech industry and big tech more generally. You know, there's the large tech platforms just don't gel with the cash system. You can't automate cash. All right. So if you think about the traditional cash transaction, it's face to face, it's on the street, it's localized. And when you think about internet giants, what the end objective of internet giants is to get you off the high street and to get you to be using digital payments online. Right. So ideologically, they're against the cash system. And so there's a lot of commercial interests at play.
Talking to Brett Scott, author of the new book out today. It's called Cloud Money, Cash, Cards, Crypto, and the War for Our Wallets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's paint a picture of a future. There's no cash. Everything you do is with a card or an internet transfer. Do you want to live in that world? Answer that question at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you buy stuff, do you like to use old-fashioned cash? Or if you sell stuff, do you have preferences between cash or card? 800-642-1234. Well, now there, Brett, I just used the phrase old-fashioned cash, which is kind of what some of the people you're talking about who are pushing a cashless society, that's an impression they're trying to create, that, hey, you stodgy person in line, slowing things down with your cash. Or this is a deliberate message that's been sent.
Absolutely. I mean, bear in mind, you know, going back to that transport metaphor I used earlier, a lot of digital payments promoters try to say that cash is like the horse-drawn cart of payments. It's some old form. Whereas that's precisely why I create the bicycle metaphors. You know, the bicycle is an older form than cars. And yet the bicycle is more popular than ever because actually it provides resilience and diversity to your transport system. And similarly, if you want a resilient, diverse payment system, you need to have the cash system in play. And this, you know, when you ask people, to some extent, this isn't about do you always use cash or not? You know, you don't have to always want to use cash. The question is, you know, do you want to keep it there as an option? Right? And this is often what I'm arguing for. And it's another sort of quick way to convey this to people is to say, you know, hey, you might find it really convenient to use an elevator to get up a very tall skyscraper, but that doesn't mean you want the emergency stairs removed. All right. So think about the cash system as being like the emergency stairs. And actually, you know, the Federal Reserve records massive increases in cash demand prior to hurricanes, precisely because cash is an offline resilient form of payment and you really want it there when there's natural disasters hit. So yeah, anybody who tries to paint cash as being some redundant thing of the past is often has a particular commercial agenda and a particular ideological agenda, and it needs to be pushed back against.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Stevens Point. Michael, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Michael?
Well, two things. One is there are some people, because of whatever credit situation they're into, just can't get a card or anything to make a digital payment. And the other thing is if money's tight and you're dealing with cash, you will decide to stop spending when the cash runs out. On a card, it can be harder to keep track of what's going on.
Michael, thanks for the call. Two interesting points. First of all, some people in a purely digital currency world, Brett, Michael's worried, will be left out.
Michael totally nailed it there, because those are two massive reasons why people actually often prefer the cash system. For a start, many people are excluded from the normal banking sector. And not only excluded, sometimes don't actually trust the banking sector. Bear in mind, there's a big class dynamic to this question, right? Often you're kind of, you know, people in big cities and stuff, they think, oh, well, it's fine, you know, obviously you use the banking sector. But actually many people who don't share that assumption that big institutions serve their interests. And even if they do, often can't get access to those institutions. But secondarily, there's a lot of research which shows people spend a lot more with digital payments. And if you're thinking about, Visa, for example, openly uses this as one of its pitches to businesses. It says people spend 25% more with card payments than with cash, right? And to Visa, this is a really good thing. But of course, if you're actually interested in budgeting and you're interested in not getting indebted, cash is a very well-tested budgeting tool. It's got this physicality, it's got these limits to it. You know what you're spending. And absolutely, Michael's totally right there.
Thanks for the call, Michael. We're talking to Brett Scott about his new book, Cloud Money, Cash, Cards, Crypto, and the War for Our Wallets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to be able to buy stuff in the future? Do you want to have that option of paying cash? Do you want to do everything with cards or online transactions? How about a little crypto in the mix? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with journalist and author Brett Scott. His new book out today is Cloud Money, Cash, Cards, Crypto, and the War for Our Wallets. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Maria is with us on Washington Island. Maria, hi.
Hi. Great program, as WPR always does. But I just wanted to share on Washington Island, and this is why I like cash or checks. Everybody's at the grocery store on Friday. It's a very small, wonderful grocery store, but their internet went down. So you've got about 50 people trying to get all their groceries for the weekend, and the only way you could pay for it is if you had cash or if you had a check. They could not accept credit cards. So there you go.
Maria, thanks for the call. Brett?
Absolutely. I mean, again, as I mentioned, you know, the Federal Reserve sees these very big increases in cash demand when there's big weather events approaching. And, you know, the saying is cash doesn't crash. And, you know, we're often told that digital, complex, large-scale digital systems are naturally better than smaller, slower analog systems. But actually, that's a very big assumption. That only really applies when the electricity is up and running and the system's up and running. You know, I'm actually based in Germany, in Berlin, and, you know, a couple of weeks ago, the entire digital payment system went down, leaving many people stranded, you know. So It's a really big, in terms of like resilience, cash plays a huge part in economic systems. And actually, if you think about it, if you think about even questions like national security, if you are totally dependent upon digital infrastructures for your economy to keep running, you run a big threat from cyber attacks, even terrorist attacks on payment systems. So one of the biggest arguments for cash right now is around its resilience and how it maintains systems.
Maria, thanks for that call. We'll go to Tim now in Eau Claire. Hi, Tim.
Hi. So there is a whole thing called the cash economy as well, where people, the guy who comes and mows my lawn, I want to be able to give him cash. The maybe even the guy who comes and roofs my house, because you might not want the government to know where all of the money comes in and all the money goes. I can see where the IRS would absolutely love a cashless society, because they would be able to track every last dime.
Tim, thanks for the call. Brett, that is something you look at in your book.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is often one of the biggest, weapons in the arsenal of the digital payments promoters, where they'll talk about how cash supposedly facilitates huge amounts of tax evasion. I don't for a moment deny that there is forms of tax evasion that occur with cash, but I would question whether the alternative is any better, because if you look at the normal digital payment system and the normal banking sector that facilitates that payment system, it facilitates huge amounts of offshore tax avoidance, right? So corporate tax avoidance. So fine, it's true that you might find a small contractor who sort of gets away with a bit of tax here and there, but the banking sector that runs the digital payment sector actively facilitates billions of dollars worth of tax avoidance for the corporate sector all the time. And they're the ones who promote digital payments. So, and the FBI has entire teams that specialize in trying to trace and track fraud and tax avoidance in digital payment systems. So this idea that cash is uniquely suited to tax avoidance is simply not true. And I don't want to romanticize the cash economy. It's a very, very important part of many people's lives.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Brett Scott about his new book, Cloud Money, Cash, Cards, Crypto, and the War for Our Wallets. Back to your calls now. Matthew is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Matthew.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, you've just basically hammered out all the points that I had brought up before, so I don't need to rehash that. So I guess off the cuff, as little as I know about crypto, is there any democratization of not having as many fees with the crypto-based economy versus standard what we use now as credit cards and fee-based or things that are based with fees currently?
Matthew, thanks for the call. And we haven't gotten to the crypto part of your subtitle yet, Brett. any advantage there, Matthew is wondering, to going to a bank and paying the bank's fees?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, maybe one thing, a broader point to just make about the crypto world is that many of the innovations that led to crypto were designed in the 1990s, when groups were looking ahead and they were saying, in a future cashless society, if it happens, we're going to need some type of alternative, quote unquote, digital cash to act, because they were concerned about the potential for corporate surveillance and state surveillance in a society where everything's tracked. And so there's a lot of history in the crypto movement about responding to an imagined future cashless society. Whether you'll pay less fees using crypto relative to banks is a question I don't necessarily know. I mean, you can pay huge amounts of fees in crypto transactions sometimes. It can be very volatile. I think the point to question is that while the crypto community has positioned itself as being this digital cash system, actually what it's really ended up being is something far more like a kind of speculative investment that can also be used for exchange. All right. And if you're a sort of small business owner or somebody just trying to, make your way in the economy, it's actually pretty unstable to be using a type of a form of exchange, which is constantly massively fluctuating in price, which is what, for example, the Bitcoin system does. So, you know, even if you do save on fees, you might be subject to all this extreme volatility all the time. And whether you want that or not is depends on who you are, I guess.
Thanks a lot for that call. One big theme, Brett, that I don't want to run out of time before we get to, there's this idea, or there was this idea, we've got these too big to fail banks and the Great Recession, and we needed something different. So here comes Silicon Valley, and they're going to disrupt the money industry, the banking industry, and give us a lot of alternatives. What I take from your book is they've been merging and cross-pollinating a lot more than that initial anticipation might have said. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, back in 2008, you know, big players like Google still had this very sort of, you know, people were quite uncritical about players like Google. They sort of saw them as being these, you know, quite cuddly corporations back in 2008, whereas the banking sector was seen as this, you know, this industry that had fallen from grace. And back at that time, this whole story came out saying, you know, well, tech will revamp finance, it'll democratize it and so on. But really what's been happening is that, especially in the realm of fintech, is what's happening has been the automation of finance, right? So a lot of these fintech companies take the same financial system and just make it faster and more automated. And really that actually ends up helping Silicon Valley to fuse with the financial sector. So if you think about a player like Amazon, for example, Amazon can't do anything unless it's plugged into huge digital payment systems. Amazon requires fintech infrastructures in order to operate in the way it does. So there's a natural synergy between big finance and big tech. And really that's what's been going on with the fusion of big finance and big tech. And one of my arguments is that one of the reasons why we have this, at least in the sort of public narrative, this idea that cash will inevitably go into decline, is that we at some level we're subject to this ideology that in the future big finance and big tech will reign supreme. Or I didn't quite put that quite right, but cash has been crushed in a sense by the forces of finance and tech trying to fuse. And people who are trying to hold on to cash, you know, in a sense you're trying to act against that. You're trying to say, actually, you know, I want to maintain localization. I want to maintain some autonomy over my money rather than having it deferred to these big players.
And just our last minute or so, apart from, you know, making a point of using cash, I guess, what else do you see as options for people who don't like this idea of a cashless society and don't like the idea of more concentration of power in those businesses you're just talking about?
Well, look, I mean, you know, going back to this metaphor of cash being the public bicycle system of payments, you've got to sort of form political movements around saying, you know, look, we don't want the payment system being totally privatized, but also the financial system more generally, building public alternatives, building a strong diversity into the system. So, you know, I'm arguing for people to take this stand. Look, I also think there are very interesting forms of alternative currencies you can dabble in, but in the book I'm not trying to promote cryptocurrency or anything like that. But I do think there's a lot of interesting experimentations you can do with local currencies and alternative types of currencies. But my main call to action right now is to just maintain the public utility of the cash system.
Brett, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. Great to be here.
That's Brett Scott, a journalist, monetary anthropologist, and former financial broker. We talked to him today about his latest book. It's out today. It's called Cloud Money, Cash, Cards, Crypto, and the War for Our Wallets. If you try to do as much as you possibly can with cash, if you run a business where you either only take cash or strongly encourage customers to use cash, love to hear your story. You can email us, ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up after the news, the cost of renting is increasing around the state as inflation and the cost of living also go up. We'll find out what's going on here in Wisconsin and hear the case for some kind of rent control along the way. You can get started on that conversation. What is rent like for you? What is renting to other people looking like to you these days? Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.